Buenas a todos, bienvenidos una semana más a Libros para Emprendedores y como siempre, los miércoles te traemos entrevistas. Y como estamos haciendo en este año, los últimos miércoles de cada mes te traemos entrevistas todavía más especiales, más espectaculares si cabe. Yo creo que todas tienen muchísimo valor, pero quizás sea porque nos está costando mucho más conseguir a personas clave en el mundo empresarial a nivel mundial, pero como sea, lo estamos consiguiendo. Esta semana te traigo a alguien súper especial para mí, una persona que he buscado largamente entrevistar. Es autor de libros, es autor de un sistema que se llama el modelo de negocio Canvas. Es un sistema para el cual ha escrito dos libros, Generación de Modelos de Negocios, se llama el primero, en el que habla de este modelo de negocios Canva, y luego también otro que se llama Creando la Propuesta de Valor, en el que también te habla, te desarrolla cómo generar propuestas de valor para tus clientes. En definitiva, libros que han sido claves en estos últimos años, en esta última media década. En el 2012 se publica más o menos el primero. Estos libros han sido claves para millones de personas. Y no exagero, millones de personas utilizan cada día sus modelos de diseño de plantillas de negocio. La evolución que se ha conseguido en este sentido es como una implementación del modelo Lean Startup, si quieres, pero en realidad lo que estamos haciendo es poner herramientas en manos de la gente, y eso es algo que ha estado haciendo nuestro invitado junto con Yves Piñol, que era su asociado a la hora de crear los libros. Hoy tenemos con nosotros a este señor, que es suizo, que se llama Alexander Osterwalder y que está ya aquí con nosotros. Hola, Alex, ¿cómo estás?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Fantástico. Alex, has escrito libros al respecto. Estás preparando también un tercer libro sobre este tema de generación de modelos de negocio. Y creas tu propia empresa que se llama Strategizer también, que no lo hemos comentado. Creas tu propia empresa Strategizer y en la que ayudas a empresas a generar más valor. Y lo haces a través de mejor diseño de sus planes de negocio. ¿Cómo se te ocurre la idea de trabajar en métodos para mejorar la planificación de negocios en una empresa?
So I've actually been working on this for 19 years together with my co-author and former PhD supervisor, Yves Piñol. So this all started with a doctoral dissertation. So Yves was looking for somebody who could help find a better way to describe business models, new ideas, a better way than business plans. Because business plans, they don't really work when it comes to entrepreneurship and innovation. So I started that, and so really the doctoral dissertation was the research that was at the was really the foundation for this. And then in 2009, we published a more accessible book, which was Business Model Generation at the time, together with Yves, because we always wanted to write a book, and that was the opportunity to make something very visual and practical to bring these ideas to the world. So really, we just wanted to come up with something better than business plans to help people shape their ideas, communicate those ideas, and actually test them. That's when we combine these tools with the Lean Startup approach by Steve Blank and Eric Ries.
Súper bien. Oye, Alex, una pregunta. En el tema de las empresas, varía un poco la estadística en cada país, pero básicamente podemos hablar de que en cada país tenemos que 3 de cada 4 empresas que se crean suelen cerrar, suelen fracasar al final o antes del segundo año de operación. Pueden cambiar un poco los números, pero creo que es una ley que se cumple bastante en la mayoría de países. ¿Por qué sucede esto? ¿Cuál crees tú que sea ese ingrediente secreto que le falta a una empresa para subsistir en este mundo actual de empresas, de generación de empresas en el tejido empresarial actual?
Yeah, so the first one, I think there's a couple of myths in entrepreneurship and innovation. And the first one is that it's all about having the right idea. I think ideas don't matter. Ideas are free. That's the easiest part. So having a good idea is maybe 1% of the work of entrepreneurship. What you really, you know, what's really hard, what you really need to do is turn an idea into two things. One is a value proposition that creates value for customers. Seems pretty obvious, but a lot of people work on things that nobody wants. That's the first one. Value for customers, pretty straightforward, but you know, sometimes we don't realize that. And then the second one is, how do I capture value for my organization? That's the business model. So you need to get both right, and they're actually very different. Creating value for customers is different than creating value for yourself, for your company. You need to get both right. And the way you do that is by starting with an idea, but admitting that probably the idea is wrong or the details are wrong, often more than the details are wrong. And you take this idea and you get out of the building, to use Steve Lang's words, and you test them and then reshape the idea. You change the idea, you change the business model, the value proposition, you go and test again. And you do that in an iterative approach until you really understand what works. And that's when you scale. And then comes the third element of, you know, any successful entrepreneurship, which is execution. So again, three things that any successful entrepreneur needs to master. How do I create value for customers? How do I capture that value in my business model? And third, how do I implement that and scale that business model in the market? So it sounds simple. It's not. So what happens is many people, they believe in their idea so much because they think it's a good idea and it might look good on paper or in a spreadsheet or in a PowerPoint, that they go and execute it. So this is what we call premature execution or premature scaling. So entrepreneurship is not about building a business first. It's about searching for a value proposition that creates value for customers and a business model that can scale profitably. Once you've found that, that's when implementation becomes a challenge. And too many people believe if they just have the right idea, they can go write a business plan and execute. That's completely wrong. So those are some, you know, the three elements that you need as a successful entrepreneur.
En el mundo actual hay una serie de frases, de palabras que se suelen decir con mucha continuidad. Una de ellas es la de que tenemos que diferenciarnos. Si tú quieres crear una empresa hoy en día, tienes que diferenciarte, tienes que ser diferente al resto, ser único. Y para eso lo que tienes que hacer es desarrollar tu propuesta única, una propuesta de valor que te permita ser diferente al resto. ¿Qué es una propuesta de valor? Tú que te encargas de llevar estas propuestas que no dejan de ser ideas, a veces etéreas, y tú te encargas de transformarlas en cosas mucho más tangibles. ¿Qué podemos decir que es una propuesta de valor y cómo desarrollarla?
It's one of the, you know, building blocks of a business model, but it's not enough, right? You can actually have a great value proposition and still go bankrupt. A lot of Kickstarter campaigns show that. They raise money because people want their product or service. They still go bankrupt. But it is an important aspect. It's one of the pillars of your business model. So the first thing is that when we say value proposition and when we say we need to be customer-centric and create value, it seems very obvious. But when you look at the processes of how people do that, it's actually not so obvious. So there's a nice experiment that I like to do. You know, sometimes when I go visit an incubator, I go to the entrepreneurs and I ask, how are you creating value for your customers? And the first thing they do is they say, my product and services does this, 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 and this. And they say, no, you didn't understand me. I didn't ask you what your products or services do. I asked you, how are you creating value for customers? They say, no, my product and service is this, this, this. So the point here is that we're very good at quantifying what our products and services do. Faster, better, cheaper, different. But all of that doesn't matter if it's not relevant to our customers. Again, that sounds trivial. But so what we want to start with is a different question. Is what are our customers trying to get done? We call that the jobs to be done concept from Tony Ulwick and Clayton Christensen and many others. What are customers trying to get done? And what are the pains preventing them from doing that job well? And what are the objectives, the gains that they try to get from those jobs, right? So first we need to understand our customer. I like to call that the customer profile. What are the jobs, pains, and gains of our customers? And let's try to quantify that. Oh, our banking customer, they are trying to, you know, increase the performance of their stock market portfolio. Okay, so tell me, how much performance? Is that 1%? Is that 5%? Is that 10%? So you want to be very explicit and be good at quantifying jobs, pains, and gains, quantifying the customer part. Once you understand the customer deeply, all of your customers' jobs, pains, and gains, Then you make choices and say, my product and service addresses these particular jobs, pains, and gains of my customer. And we call that the value map. So every value proposition has two components. Who are you targeting? That's the customer segment. And what are that customer segment's jobs, pains, and gains? So now you understood the customer side. And now you make explicit, how are you alleviating pains, like a headache pill, taking those pains away from your customer? Or how are you creating gains? How are you helping your customer achieve those objectives? So it's all about making these things explicit. Now, entrepreneurs have done this for a long time intuitively, and the good ones have thought this through very systematically. All what we are trying to do is to make this explicit and very systematic. That's why we like talking about visual tools, because you start mapping it out. You make a map of your customers' jobs, pains, and gains, and you make a map of how you're creating value. And again, initially, when you think of your idea, your map is probably wrong. But the more you talk to those customers, the better you will understand their jobs, the better you will understand their pains, the better you will understand their gains. It's a non-trivial thing to map that out explicitly. And you'll always get contradicting information. Some people will say, I want to do this. Some people will say they want to do that. But it's the entrepreneur's job to see patterns in what people say, to see patterns in some of that contradicting data, and then create value. Because entrepreneurship is not just about learning, it's about making choices which aspects of your customers you want to address. Now, one more point, you were talking about differentiation. I think differentiation, of course, is important, but you know, I like to quote Jeff Bezos here. He says, you know, let's not focus too much on competition, because as long as we, and he means Amazon in that case, as long as we focus on customers and do a good job for customers, you know, we'll be fine. And competition actually matters less than we think, because if we focus on customers, we will understand what customers need, and automatically we'll differentiate. So let's not start with differentiation. Let's start with satisfying the jobs, pains, and gains of customers, and automatically we will do things differently, because they will tell you why they can't get things done. They will tell you which products don't work for them. So differentiation is more of an outcome than a goal, in my opinion, because if we focus on customers, differentiation will happen naturally.
Parece una obviedad que tienes que conocer a tus clientes, parece una obviedad que tienes que conocer tus productos. Y para conocer a tus clientes, tus productos y desarrollar el mejor producto de acuerdo a las necesidades de tu cliente, está claro que tienes que ir a hablar con tus clientes. Eso es de lógica. Sin embargo, tú que, por ejemplo, generas un modelo de negocio que es teórico, no deja de ser un plano en el que dibujas un poco cómo quieres que sea tu negocio, tú que creas ese modelo de negocio y que se lo trasladas a la gente, ¿no te sucede que la gente prefiere quedarse en ese marco teórico? ¿Prefiere quedarse dibujando cómo debería ser mi empresa antes que salir afuera, que salir a la calle a preguntarle a los clientes? ¿No te sucede eso, que la gente prefiere quedarse dándole vueltas a su idea que en realidad no exponerla al público, no preguntarle al público sobre qué tal es su idea? ¿No te ha sucedido eso? Y si te sucede, que yo creo que sí te sucede, ¿qué haces? ¿Cómo consigues empujar a la gente a que, como decimos nosotros, pase a la acción, que salga ahí fuera, que se exponga y que hable con los clientes? ¿Cómo conseguimos que alguien salga de ese caparazón teórico y se ponga en la calle a preguntarle a los clientes sobre su producto o su idea de producto?
So, again, I think it comes back to some of the myths in entrepreneurship. So, people think, you know, you need to get the perfect idea to get it right. That's not the case. And what reinforces that is we put, you know, successful entrepreneurs on the covers of magazines, and it looks as if they were just smart enough to come up with the right idea, and then maybe they talk to some customers to get the details right. If you really study successful entrepreneurs, you will see that there's a long trail of failure. They learned a lot. They got a lot of things right. Even, you know, those creative geniuses like Steve Jobs, we like to say, oh, he didn't have to ask customers. Look at how many things he got wrong. And that's why he got some things right. So basically, I believe the biggest skill of an entrepreneur and innovators is to humiliate yourself every day. Because you have a crazy idea, you think this needs to be done, and you go talk to customers about things where they will probably at the beginning tell you, that is stupid, that doesn't work, you would destroy my business if you did that. But then you investigate, you go deeper, and eventually you'll figure out what you should really be doing. So I think the ability to be wrong and get up again and try something else and understand, you know, seeing those patterns is crucial. Now, one aspect is talking to customers. Of course, easy to do, never done enough. And here's a big thing. Even something as simple as talking to customers, you can do completely wrong and go off on the wrong path. So I like to do this little exercise with entrepreneurs and innovators across the world and tell them, you know, they have to play this role-playing game where they interview a customer. And I give them basically the solution. Let's say, oh, you know, you have this new high-tech cup and you need to go out, get out of the building and ask if there's a market for this high-tech cup. And the first thing people do is they ask, would you buy this? Do you think this is interesting? What do you like about this? Here's a big mistake. So we think we're customer-centric because I'm asking questions. But here's the big mistake. This is all about questions around opinion. Would you like this? People can always say, of course, I think that's great. That color is great. But it doesn't indicate anything around real actual behavior. What people say is rarely what they do. So would you buy this? Oh yeah, I'd love to buy a cup like that. Well, how does that prove they will? So you want to frame the questions already differently and ask, when's the last time you bought a cup like this? When's the last time you bought a technology product, you know, in a household product? When's the last time you did this or that? Oh, tell me about that situation. What were your purchasing criteria? Those are real facts. So people tend to ask questions around opinions rather than around facts. So already there, you can go completely wrong. If you start building products and services based on people's opinions, I can guarantee you're probably off on the wrong path. So we think we're being customer-centric, but we're actually not, because we're talking to them about what they think they should be doing rather than their real behavior in the past. That's why it's important to go back and ask, when's the last time you did something? When's the last time you spent money on this? That's the first step. And then later on, you come up with some very concrete artifacts or prototypes, or we like to call them sometimes minimal viable products, to test them. So you could, for example, for products that are very hard to prototype physically, you can make a PDF document. So you just have this one document, PDF, with the spec sheet, the performance of your product. And you put it in front of customers and talk about the product and say, look, this is the performance of my product. How does this fit with your current needs? And you have a very good and concrete conversation around something, I don't know, maybe a ship turbine or something that's very expensive to prototype. So it's really about having better conversations and as much fact-based as possible with your customers. This is not easy. It sounds trivial, but people are usually not trained to do that. And what you'll see is your first 10 conversations are completely off. Your second 10 conversations, you start to see some patterns and you ask better questions. And then your next 10 questions will, or next interviews, will be a lot more around priorities and around jobs, pains, and gains. So we can get a lot better at these, so, you know, these techniques that look so easy. It's actually very sophisticated how this whole movement is evolving from pure interviews to very sophisticated interviews to real experiments to test things like willingness to pay.
Estamos hablando con Alexander Osterwalder, que es el creador del modelo de negocio Canvas. El modelo de negocio Canvas, que es uno de los modelos de negocio actualmente más utilizados en el mundo. Millones de personas lo utilizan cada día y creo que con mucho éxito, porque es un marco teórico en el que pensar sobre tu empresa. Si tú tienes una idea de negocio, puedes agarrar esa hojita del modelo de negocios y con unos post-its ir colocando ahí muy rápidamente tus ideas, lo que crees que debería funcionar. Y Alex, ¿no es cierto que al final tú esto lo puedes hacer en media hora? O sea, al final tú puedes coger tu modelo de negocio Canvas y en media hora tener tu idea plasmada completamente. Mucha gente, pasar de esa idea a tenerla en la cabeza, a tenerla en papel, ya es un éxito en sí mismo. Pero, ¿cuál sería el siguiente paso para que alguien que ya ha trasladado la idea al papel, ya ha puesto su modelo de negocio Canvas con todos sus post-its y todas sus cositas ahí puestos, ¿cuál sería el siguiente paso? ¿Tendrías que ir a hablar con el cliente, como comentábamos antes? ¿Cuál sería el siguiente paso que alguien debería hacer para no quedarse, como decíamos antes, en ese modelo teórico que acabas de desarrollar?
So for me, you know, the business model, sometimes people say, yeah, but I first need to get the value proposition right. No, I don't think so. I think business model and value proposition go hand in hand. So the way we like to frame this is sketch out your idea as fast as you can, half an hour, definitely not more than half a day, right? Make a prototype with a value proposition canvas of how you think you're going to create value for your customer. Make a prototype of your business model, how you think you're going to design the business model, including how much money you're going to earn and how much money you're going to spend. So in something between half an hour and maybe half a day, you have the full picture. What you would usually take weeks for in a business plan. Do it as fast as you can. And then you admit, I don't know if this is going to work. The second step after this is, you have your value proposition canvas, you have your business model canvas. The second step is, you don't know if this is going to work. And that's very humbling, right? Because you're smart, you have all this experience, you need to accept that you don't know if you're going to get it right. Then you ask yourself, what are the hypotheses or the guesses or the assumptions underlying my idea that I just sketched out? You know, which customer needs to exist? How am I going to earn money? What's the pricing? What is the cost structure? So you make all of these hypotheses explicit, all of the guesses that need to be true for this idea to work. And then you use a tool from a guy called David Bland called assumptions mapping. And with that assumptions mapping, you ask yourself, what is the biggest hypothesis, the most uncertain assumption, and the most important one for which I don't have facts? So typically, you know, you could say, oh, this customer segment, they would need to own a smartphone, the latest iPhone or Android phone for me to offer this service. That's an assumption. If your business model relies on that, that's your most important assumption that you need to test first. So with the assumptions mapping, you make all of your assumptions explicit and you prioritize the most critical assumption. And this is something entrepreneurs don't do very often, and the lean startup method hasn't been explicit enough so far, is you take your business model canvas, your value proposition canvas, you make your assumptions explicit and hypothesis, and then you prioritize. And the first and foremost, most important hypothesis, that's the one you test first. So often people would go out and start testing a product, or they would test if they can build this new technology. That's usually not the most important assumption, right? So you go and start to test the most important assumptions. If those assumptions turn out to be true, oh yeah, people have that newest model of the iPhone, at least 10% of the people I want to target. You say, okay, validate it, and you go on to the next assumption. And often you'll be wrong, so you have to change your idea. So the business model canvas and the value proposition canvas become more like a map that you continuously change. So it's not just about prototyping products and services, it's a lot more about prototyping value propositions and business models and asking yourself, which hypothesis do I need to test and how will I test those? And then you will experiment, and the more you learn, the more you will reduce the risk. And at one point, you will get to that stage where you have enough information from the market to say, I think this is really going to work, and you can start investing in building or scaling. We like to call these sprints, consecutive sprints. The first couple of weeks, you probably test something we like to call desirability. Do customers want it? Maybe you already start testing viability. Will customers pay for that? Can I make enough money from it? Then after maybe 3 months or so, you start testing feasibility. Actually build that. So it's really consecutive sprints. And in those sprints, you need to learn as much as you can until you figure out what could really work. And this is a hardcore job. And so far, entrepreneurs have learned this more on an anecdotal basis without too much structure. Some were better at it, some not so good. Today, we can do this with system by mixing together business model canvas, value proposition canvas, lean startup, agile, okay, putting those all together, we can be very systematic. Because this is a hardcore job, and most entrepreneurs, they actually deal with their first five ventures until they get it right. It's just that we don't see that the successful entrepreneurs on the cover of a magazine, they've already been in four startups before they created their own and raised money. So we don't know that they learned a lot already. Entrepreneurship is a little bit like learning tennis and becoming a Roger Federer. Roger Federer didn't fall from the sky. He trains a lot, right? And that's why he's still one of the best tennis players in the world.
Totalmente cierto, ¿eh? Totalmente cierto. Oye, Alexander, estábamos hablando de precisamente de este marco teórico, ¿no? Tú estás desarrollando tu modelo de negocio Canvas y mucha gente lo utiliza, como decíamos, como una zona de seguridad. Es mi zona de confort. Se está mucho más cómodo diseñando sobre papel porque el papel lo aguanta todo. Entonces, está mucho más cómodo diseñando en papel, pero llega un momento en que tienes que pasar a la acción, tienes que salir ahí fuera. ¿Cómo saber? Porque la gente, mucha gente, permíteme, está siempre dándole vueltas a cómo sacar la idea perfecta, el negocio perfecto, cómo arrancar de forma perfecta. Y eso les impide arrancar, esperan a la perfección. Entonces, ¿cómo saber en qué momento puedes salir ahí fuera? Puedes salir ahí fuera y exponer tu idea al mundo. ¿Cómo saber cuándo estás preparado para hacerlo?
Yes, and again, I think that's a very accurate way of framing it. You want to avoid analysis paralysis. So, you know, these methods don't mean you need to learn forever, and it's not about learning. It's all about making decisions to reduce uncertainty and getting out there and launching the business. So the question you really want to ask yourself is, how risky is this idea, you know, still? If you start to, you know, reduce, get some data from the market, and reduce risk and uncertainty. Oh yeah, I can see that, you know, maybe 10% of the market have that particular challenge. Oh, actually of those 10%, all of them said they have a budget. So you need to act. And it's not as if, you know, these methods are going to take away all of the risk. There is still some risk involved in entrepreneurship, but you're making calculated bets. So the whole idea is that you never bet more than you can survive, right? So if you have a runway, let's say, you know, you have funding for 3 months, you need to make sure that you make the right decisions to get to the next stage. And it is all about, you know, making that, taking those actions to get towards either scaling, then you need to raise money, or starting to make revenues. Because it's all about creating a business, it's not about learning. And it is true that people sometimes get stuck in analysis paralysis because they think they need to make it perfect. Great entrepreneurs know the information you're going to get from the market and from stakeholders is always going to be contradictory. As long as you start to see patterns, as long as not everything is against you, when everybody tells you this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, probably something is wrong. But here is where there's a fine line, and this, I think, is the challenge of entrepreneurship beyond the analysis paralysis. Entrepreneurs, they always have a vision, and they want to go in a certain direction. And lean startup doesn't mean you need to pivot like crazy and give up on that vision. For me, the vision is like where you want to go, but how to get there, that path, is what you learn through testing. So we got to be careful because there's a fine line. Steve Lang likes to say this, you know, the father of the lean startup movement. There's a fine line between vision and hallucination. So you want to be a very careful listener, but you don't want to do everything that your customers say because otherwise you're going to go off in 20 different directions. You want to make sure that what you see from the market helps you get a little bit closer towards that vision, towards implementing that vision. So entrepreneurship means having a vision and a direction, Lean startup means figuring out that path towards that vision, towards implementing that vision. And sometimes you're just wrong. And you know what? Entrepreneurship will not always work. Not everybody will be able to create a unicorn. Sometimes, you know, you're able to build a $5 million business, sometimes a $50 million business, sometimes a $100 million business. Or sometimes you learn when you need to quit. So the dirty secret, I think, of the lean startup movement is you can't pivot yourself to success. Sometimes you need to call it a day and say, there's nothing there. My vision was wrong. And you need to quit. And that should usually happen in the earlier stages when you haven't wasted a lot of venture capital money or a lot of your own time. So there is always this fine line between vision and hallucination. So that's the beauty of entrepreneurship. There's more and more of this part science, but the art part will not go away. Entrepreneurship is always going to be about creativity. It's just like designers. It's not about creative genius. Designers go to architectural school. They go to design school, industrial design. There's method to it. Method means we can get better at it, more systematic. It doesn't take away the creativity part.
Me encanta. Pero, Alex, esto que estamos comentando y en general tu propuesta en cuanto a la creación de modelos de negocio, se suele utilizar, dime si estoy equivocado, pero se suele utilizar sobre todo en startups y en empresas que están arrancando, incluso empresas que no han comenzado, que no han arrancado todavía. Se acostumbra a utilizar el Canvas, en este caso, pues para diseñar un poco cómo podría ser el futuro perfecto, ¿no? Pero dime si no es cierto que tu modelo es muy útil también para empresas ya establecidas. Tú puedes tener una empresa ya establecida, una empresa que superó esos famosos 2 años en los que van cayendo 3 de cada 4 empresas, superó esos 2 años, ya ha crecido, a lo mejor incluso está en una fase estable, en una fase en la que no crece ni decrece, tiene ingresos, paga las facturas. ¿Qué puede o cómo podría una empresa en esa situación implementar el modelo de negocio Canvas? Primero, seguramente para tener una foto de su situación actual, pero también para tener una visión estratégica de hacia dónde podrían ir o hacia dónde tendría que ir esa empresa que ya existe aplicando el modelo de negocios Canvas.
Yeah, so I think what is happening is that in the startup world, even in the startup world, you create something new. It expires faster than ever before, and you already need to think about the next wave. So if we take the tools, the whole lean startup approach and so, it applies just as well in established organizations, and there it's easy to make the case and say, look, every business model expires, every company one day will end up like Kodak, so you have to either reinvent yourself or create new business models to keep on growing, in particular when you reach a certain size. We like to call that a business model portfolio. And that's what our newest book is about, which is going to come out in November, business model portfolios. Here are the businesses I'm managing, and I can improve the business model. Here are the businesses that I'm creating. So I need to work on both existing businesses and improve them, new businesses that I want to create the next wave. So that's typically for established companies, you know, even for small and medium-sized companies. But what's happening now is that even for startups, their success is shorter and shorter because there are more and more competition and copycats. And when your business model is hard to protect, there will be others that are coming up. So you already need to think of the next wave while you are building the current wave. So some people like to call this the S-curve, right? You need to reinvent the future while you're successfully scaling the current business model. So even for startups or young companies, not at the very early stage, of course, because then you just want to figure out your business model and scale it. But once you've figured it out and you're starting to scale, don't forget that, you know, there is a point where others are going to come in, because if you're in an attractive market and you have an attractive business model, definitely there's going to be a lot of competition. So they're going to start to copy you. So you need to already continue to improve this business model and invent new ones. And here's where people, I think entrepreneurs and established, you know, very successful managers of multi-billion dollar business units, that's who I work with, both of them, both categories, they don't actually understand business models well enough. So, you know, a simple example is you want to make sure that you are not in a transactional business selling stuff. You want to be in a recurring business with recurring revenues where you sell once and earn money again and again and again. That is business model design. It's a pretty trivial design question. How can I make sure I'm not in a transactional business, but in a recurring business? And as trivial as it sounds, we don't design that business model assessment into our processes. I'll give you an example. GoPro was, it still is a pretty successful company, was hyped by the stock market, but their business model is a disaster. It's a transactional business model selling stuff that is easy to copy. So the only thing that was keeping them ahead was their brand. Now, what they try to figure out, but they didn't successfully, is how can they turn that into a better business model with recurring revenues, with lock-in? So one of the things that we're trying to do now is really help people understand how they can design better business models. Because people always think, oh, it's all about the product. The product is just one aspect. What it really is about is better business models. And that's for startups and for established companies alike. I'll give you an extreme example. Think of a company, ask yourself, which company outcompeted everybody else with an inferior technology? They innovated with an inferior technology. Sounds completely counterintuitive. They beat the whole competition with inferior technology. Nintendo Wii. When Nintendo launched the Nintendo Wii, they launched a game console that was technologically inferior to the Sony PlayStation 2 at the time or the Xbox, but they had a different business model, targeting casual gamers with motion control and off-the-shelf technology. So we need to get away from that thinking that products and technology, maybe better services, is where the competition is. No, that could be a part of it. Technology innovation can be part of the business model innovation, but it doesn't have to be. So what entrepreneurs need to learn and establish businesses is to get a lot better at business model thinking. And that's where we're trying with our new book to kind of make up for what we didn't know in the past, that people would fill out the boxes of this business model canvas, but not necessarily understand the power of business models.
Ya tengo ganas de que llegue ese libro y lo vamos a revisar, por supuesto, en el programa. Alexander, estamos hablando de empresas establecidas y estamos hablando del desarrollo de una serie de sistemas, lo cual es súper útil, pero el mayor activo de una empresa es su gente. El mayor activo de una empresa son sus empleados. ¿Qué opinas o qué podríamos desarrollar sobre el tema de cultura corporativa? Creo que es un tema esencial, la cultura corporativa, pero sin embargo estamos en una situación actual en la que cada vez hay más gente que trabaja remotamente, no está presente, en el que parece que el tema de la cultura corporativa se puede estar dejando de lado precisamente porque nos enfrentamos a una nueva situación, a un nuevo mundo en el que las reglas están cambiando y las cosas no son como eran antes. ¿Qué podría hacer una empresa para desarrollar ese tema de cultura corporativa?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point to mention. Even in the startup world, there, you have two different cultures. One culture is about managing your existing business model or scaling one that you figured out could be successful. That's management. That's one type of business. The other culture is entrepreneurship and innovation, which is not about management. It's about the search and iteration until you find, until you validated your ideas. In established companies, these cultures need to live side by side. It's not that management is better than innovation or innovation is better than management. They need to live under the same roof, two very different types of culture. Here, you make big investments into established things, so failure is not an option when you are exploiting an existing business model. When Amazon, builds a new warehouse, failure is not an option. However, over here in innovation, when Amazon tries out new things, Failure is okay because we make small bets and iterate. So there's a different kind of decision making. So we need to make sure we know, always depending on the task we're doing, which culture we're in. Are we in an entrepreneurship and innovation culture where we're trying to reduce uncertainty, or are we in a execution culture where we're managing our existing business model and we, you know, take maybe bigger risks because we don't have that much uncertainty? So making those two cultures explicit, having different rules, different incentive systems, different processes for these two different cultures, that is crucial. So guess what? We obviously created a tool for that called the culture map, because one of the big things we realized when it comes to innovation, culture is a big thing. So the culture map is very simple, and it allows you to make a specific culture explicit, management culture or innovation culture, by understanding the drivers you would need to put in place to let that culture emerge. Culture is something you can manage, we believe, because you can make it tangible. It's not something you should just let happen. It's something you need to take in your hands, you need to shape and manage. And you can only do that when you make it explicit. One of the big things we believe at Strategizer is taking these abstract things and making them explicit so we can play with them, so we can design them, so we can test them, so we can manage them.
Existe un concepto en el que yo he estado trabajando mucho últimamente, que es el de la mentalidad emprendedora, el entrepreneurial mindset, y que básicamente busca motivar a los empleados en una empresa para que se sientan parte proactiva de ella, que no sean simplemente empleados que reciben órdenes o cumplen con su trabajo, sino que sean proactivos, que aporten de alguna manera como si fueran emprendedores, que tengan esa mentalidad emprendedora, esa mentalidad de desarrollo, de crecimiento. ¿Qué opinas tú de este concepto de desarrollar la mentalidad emprendedora, desarrollar la proactividad para los empleados de una empresa?
I'd be careful with saying everybody needs to be an innovator or everybody needs to be an entrepreneur, because it turns out, you know, we're all different. We have different skills and strengths and competencies. So entrepreneurial mindset depends a bit, right? I think when somebody is managing a supply chain, entrepreneurial mindset means something different than when somebody is trying to create a new business. So yes, people need to learn and grow. So it's that growth mindset that we want to have everywhere, because that will help people kind of grow and get to the next level. But it's different for somebody who is managing a supply chain or managing the accounting, and somebody over here who's doing innovation, you know, trying to build an entire new growth engine. So I think the most important thing is, so I think where you're really spot on is employee happiness, that people, you know, kind of figure out what do they like doing, what are they good at, and what is, you know, interesting for the company or the market. And once they figured that out, so it's a self-discovery journey, they work in a position that allows them to bring in those strengths and that pleasure. So again, not everybody needs to be an innovator, because it's not for everybody, right? Some people like more certainty, then they shouldn't be in an innovation or entrepreneurship role. Some people don't like rigid processes, then they definitely shouldn't be maybe in a very concrete management role to manage a supply chain. So I think what's increasingly important, the way I like to frame it, is people need to figure out what are they about, and then companies have the responsibility to make sure their culture is explicit, their job roles are explicit, so people can fit into a role where they can, you know, bring the best, or the company and themselves, they can get the best out of that. So I don't think there's a right and wrong culture. I don't think there's the right and wrong mindset. It's just the right person in the right job description, in the right company, which sounds trivial again, is not always the case. That's why we have so many unhappy employees. But I think it's a crucial role. And I really do think new companies like Netflix or HubSpot, they're making that culture explicit and they're redefining the workplace. It's very exciting to watch that.
tú estás mencionando, mentalidad de crecimiento, ese growth mindset que estás mencionando, realmente es algo súper deseable. Yo lo escucho y digo, yo quiero eso para mi empresa, evidentemente. Quiero que mis empleados tengan eso. ¿Qué le podemos decir a alguien, a un empresario que tenga una empresa con sus trabajadores, que son trabajadores que cumplen con su horario, que cobran su sueldo, que se van a casa a su hora, que llegan a cada día a su hora? Es decir, que cumplen con lo pactado, pero que no tienen esa inquietud por crecer. Hay empleados que no quieren crecer, que no quieren desarrollarse más. Y nosotros, cuando hablamos de mentalidad de crecimiento, estamos hablando de personas que queremos que sean más parte activa de la empresa, pero nos encontramos que cuando queremos implantar eso en nuestras empresas, hay empleados que no lo aceptan, que quieren seguir como hasta ahora, que están en su zona de confort y que no los quieres mover. ¿Cómo les puedes inyectar esa necesidad de crecimiento? ¿Cómo les puedes inyectar a esas personas que se inspiren un poco en esa mentalidad de crecimiento, de desarrollarse y de ser más proactivos?
So again, I'd almost be careful and say, well, look, what you want to create is a workplace where the culture is explicit. So typically, one of the things at Strategizer that we say in the culture is we want people who are hungry and want to do their best work ever in their career. And we try to make that explicit in the hiring process, to make that culture explicit. So the people who we hire or the people who join us, that it's a win-win situation. Again, I don't think everybody wants to, you know, grow or live with uncertainty or get to the next level. And that's okay. I think people need to, you know, people and companies with the same kind of mindset need to find each other. And that starts with the hiring process. So there's no right and wrong. There's no value judgment here. People, you know, if a company wants to grow, wants to advance, wants to get to the next level, that culture needs to be explicit so that the people that company is hiring correspond to that mindset and they know what they're getting in. Sometimes people don't know, right? So that's actually what they're looking for. So again, I think it's all about making the culture explicit and hiring accordingly. And some companies are really now starting to make that culture explicit. Again, I think Netflix is an interesting one. There's a book by Patty McCord. She talks about the culture that they created at Netflix. HubSpot, the founder, one of the co-founders, has written an excellent book on culture as well. So it's really about matching the right people with the right culture. So I think this is more of a fitting. Not everybody would fit in at Strategizer, okay? Maybe we're not looking for those kind of people. And again, it's not a value judgment. It's really just about matchmaking. So people find the right company, and in the right company, they find the right jobs. Again, it's not a value judgment. Sometimes at our company, we might not have the right technical challenge for somebody in our team. So they will go look for somewhere else where they can find that right technical challenge. So really, I've got a lot more relaxed on this and saying it's all about matchmaking. Right people, right situation, right company. That's most important to create a happy workspace.
Pues por eso Tinder es un éxito, ¿no?
Yeah.
Okay.
We need the same thing for the workplace, I think. So makes it more complicated, right? Because then we all know that actually finding the right partner for the right situation is a difficult task. I think it's the same thing for a job. And I think we're almost less demanding finding the right job than we are for finding the right partner. I think the ability to find a workplace that is fulfilling should be like the number one thing. And it doesn't need to be the craziest job. Some people don't want to have a crazy, hectic life, and that's okay, right? So I do think matchmaking, you know, kind of the Tinder for work, is going to become very relevant beyond the traditional kind of job websites that we have today or beyond LinkedIn, really taking the cultural aspect and the human aspect a lot more into account than we have so far. I think it's a good actually comparison.
Creo que tienes toda la razón. De hecho, piensas si no existe ninguna aplicación de ese tipo, no existe ninguna página web que haga, que cumpla con esa función, ¿no? Sí existen los LinkedIns del mundo, pero no existe esa aplicación precisamente en la que podamos buscar, podamos hacer ese matching, ¿no? Podemos hacer ese, tenemos una empresa con estas características y aquí buscamos un empleado con estas características. No existe y probablemente sí debería existir, ¿no?
I think we're not demanding enough when it comes to workplace happiness. We're still, you know, picking jobs based on responsibility and salary mainly, where we should maybe focus a lot more on picking the places we work at in terms of culture. I do think that is a trend that's happening with younger people now, that it's not just about the job responsibilities, the career and the salary, but it's a lot more about identity. I think it's happening. I mean, we're spending, you know, at least eight hours per day at work, some people 16 hours. We better be happy, right? Because we're spending more time at work than with our loved ones in many cases. So we better find a place that really fulfills us.
Excelente. Estamos hablando con Alex Osterwalder, autor de varios libros, Generación de Modelos de Negocio, Generando la Propuesta de Valor. En definitiva, Alex, que yo sé que eres un gran lector, me gustaría que, ya que estamos en Libros para Emprendedores, nos recomendaras algún libro o algunos libros en este caso que nos puedan servir como emprendedores. Hemos estado hablando de muchos temas, cultura de empresa, de emprendimiento. ¿Qué libros le recomendarías a un emprendedor o a un empresario que les puedan ayudar en su camino o a sortear esos problemas que hemos estado comentando?
It's always hard to single out a couple of books. When it comes to, you know, the entrepreneurial process, I would really single out two authors, right now and their blogs. So Steve Lang for me has been a huge inspiration. Was a serial entrepreneur, now an educator. So all of his writings, not just the books, but also the blog, stevelang.com, is something you really want to look at as an entrepreneur and learn. And then Eric Ries, who was one of his students, you know, with the Lean Startup, I think is also a very excellent input into the entrepreneurial process. One thing that is coming up from David Bland, so you can also Google David Bland, Strategizer is publishing a book by David Bland on a testing library. So what are those experiments beyond the interviews that I can conduct that is going to come out after summer? So just keep connected at strategizer.com. Those are the three really to the testing techniques. Then I'm very interested in culture. So I would really read the books from Patty McCord on the Netflix culture and the books by HubSpot. Can't recall the title right now on culture as well. There are SlideShare decks out there, so you can also Google SlideShare, HubSpot, and Netflix, and you'll get their slide deck if you're more into that than in reading. I like Ray Dalio's Principles, so maybe a bit on the colder side of culture, very tough, but it's about idea competition, right? Ideas win over hierarchy, so I think that's a very important one. Fascinating. I found how not to do entrepreneurship is bad blood. It's about the whole story around Temenos and how that went down the drain. Then one thing as an entrepreneur that from the beginning we used in our hiring process, also related to culture, is Bob Sutton's work, Stanford professor, on the no asshole rule, literally called the no asshole rule, which is really important about not hiring just, you know, high performers who will have a bad impact on your culture. And then around creativity, if you're into that part, I would really look at Tina Selig's work around creativity. Always has a huge series of books and blog posts on the topic. So there's tons. Probably forgot half of the stuff I'm listening to at the moment. I listen to audiobooks. But those are kind of the foundations, I think, in terms of innovation, entrepreneurship, creativity, and organizational culture at the moment that I would look into and recommend.
Pues muchísimas gracias. Yo decía algún libro y nos ha regalado un listado completo. Entonces, muchísimas gracias, Alex. Eres una persona muy ocupada. Te agradezco muchísimo tu tiempo que nos hayas dedicado, aparte con esta generosidad, superando el tiempo que habíamos comentado, que hayas dedicado este tiempo a esta entrevista y que nos hayas aportado tantísimo valor, que nos hayas ayudado a entender mucho mejor los enfoques. Me ha encantado la cantidad de ideas. Me voy con un montón de ideas que ya quiero investigar y profundizar más. De nuevo, muchísimas gracias por estar aquí. Ha sido una entrevista que ha costado muchísimo conseguir y por fin te tenemos aquí, pero ha valido muchísimo la pena. Te agradezco de nuevo tu tiempo. Muchísimas gracias por estar aquí. Gracias, Alex Osterwalder.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure. Great conversation. Thank you.
Super, pues muchísimas gracias al señor Osterwalder, que estamos esperando ya con ansias ese nuevo libro que se publicará, parece ser, este año, y ojalá podamos apoyar y podamos revisar ese libro también muy pronto, entonces, en Libros para Emprendedores. Recuerda que las notas del programa, los enlaces a todos los libros que hemos comentado, todo lo que necesitas saber sobre este invitado, lo tienes en las notas del programa. Si lo escuchas a través del podcast, vas a tener las notas ahí abajo. A través de YouTube también tienes las notas. A través de cualquier navegador o cualquier escuchador de podcast, ahí los vas a tener también. Y si no, recuerda que puedes ir a librosparaemprendedores.net y ahí también tienes todos los episodios de todos los podcasts que hemos generado desde el principio de los tiempos. Ahí lo tienes todo y también de este episodio tienes sus notas del programa completo. Espero que te haya gustado mucho la entrevista, espero que hayas aprendido mucho, da mucho que pensar. Hemos hablado de temas de emprendimiento, de innovación, de cultura empresarial, temas brutales, temas que me encantaron hablar con esta persona y, por lo tanto, te recomiendo que si quieres seguir creciendo, si quieres seguir desarrollándote, que leas también la página de Alexander. Se llama strategizer.com, aquí lo tienes aquí abajo escrito porque sí, se escribe de una manera así diferente, strategizer.com, y ahí encuentras un montón de información en su blog con un montón de plantillas. Te puedes descargar gratuitamente su plantilla. En definitiva, tienes un montón de ayudas también en su página. Terminamos, señoras y señores. Muchísimas gracias por vuestra atención, por haber estado ahí. Espero que hayáis disfrutado esta entrevista. Sí, es en inglés, no las estamos doblando. Creo que pues las personas que puedan entender el inglés se benefician, en este caso, de escuchar directamente al autor. Y los que no entiendan inglés, recuerden que también pueden escucharla y verla a través de YouTube. Y en YouTube cuenta con subtítulos, por lo tanto pueden ver la entrevista. A mí ya me escuchan y ya me entienden, supongo. Y al invitado también lo pueden ver y lo pueden entender a través de los subtítulos. ¿De acuerdo? Muchísimas gracias por vuestra atención. Un abrazo muy grande de Luis Ramos. Nos vemos la próxima semana aquí en Libros para Emprendedores con un nuevo mentor de nuestra sección de mentores. ¡Saludos! ¡Hasta luego!